Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com. Hi, I'm Tobias Carlisle. This is the Acquirers Podcast. My special guest today is Andrew Walker of Rangeley Capital. He runs the Special Ops Fund there. We're going to talk about SPACs. We're going to talk about Dropbox. We're going to talk about how you find companies transitioning from small, micro, special situations into compounders, where he sees Match, where he sees IAC, where he sees Angie's List, right after this.
Tobias Carlisle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
So what's your background, Andrew?
Okay. So my background, I graduated and went and worked for a lot of the traditional kind of finance and consulting firms. And about 5 years ago, I was thinking about continuing kind of on that ladder and moving up in the big in the finance world with a bigger firm. And, you know, I loved it there. I know a lot of people like to hate on private equity firms and all this, but I found the people there were fantastic. They were sharp. They were nice. I loved working there. I've got nothing but praise to say about them. So I was thinking about staying there. And about 5 years ago, I was like, well, you know, I was 27 and single at the time. I was like, if I'm ever going to go do something a little more entrepreneurial where I can kind of, you know, call my own shots and go on a podcast when I want to and all this sort of stuff and hustle a little bit more. Not that I wasn't working hard, but just like kind of start something and grow with my own hands. Now's probably the time. So about 5 years ago, I talked to Chris DeMuth and his partners at Rangeley Capital for a while. And about 5 years ago, I made the switch and went over to Rangeley and launched my own fund. And from that, you know, I run my own fund. I work with Chris, and we've got a lot of, I don't want to call them side hustles because they all like kind of work together. But, you know, I've got all the public facing stuff, yet another value blog, yet another value podcast, all this type of stuff that have come out of that as well.
How did you meet Chris?
So I was in college, I was writing a very small time website called Whopper Investments. And it was mainly focused on real deep value stuff that I think you probably know pretty well. You know, microcaps, net nets, all that type of stuff. And we actually overlapped on a couple of different investments, but the coolest one was there was this one investment. It was $100 million cable channel called Outdoor Networks. And they got a bid to get bought out for $8 per share. And a month later, Stanley Kroenke, who he's married into the Walmart fortune, he owns the Colorado Avalanche, and I think he owns the Denver Broncos. I think he's the owner of the Denver Broncos. But anyway, he's like a multi billionaire. And he came in and he said, "Hey, I will pay $8.80 per share for this cable channel." And the stock traded to $8.60. And if you read through the merger agreement, there were all these interesting things in the merger agreement. But the most interesting one was, it was not only was there no financing condition, which a financing condition says you and I want to go buy something. We say, hey, we've got a bank who's going to back us. It said there was no finance condition, but it said Stanley Kroenke, a man who is worth $10 billion, personally guarantees that if you sign this deal with him, it will go through. Right. So this is $150 million cable channel or something. And the stock traded for $8.60 and the offer price was $8.70 or $8.80 or something. And we said, this is free money, right? Like, we have a bidding war situation, and the backstop right now is a man whose personal net worth covers this cable channel's value, you know, 50 times over. So I think both of us, you know, I was just out of college, so I was running a personal account, and Chris was running a little bit more money, but I think both of us really backed the truck up on this, and it turned into a mini bidding war. I think the final price was like $10 per share or something. I'm probably getting some of the numbers wrong, but the basics were there were these really quirky situations, and Chris and I worked on a couple of them. That was probably the highlight over the years. So when I was, when I was 27 and single and thinking, do I want to go do something on my own or move on? I'd stayed in touch with Chris for a long time. He said, hey, I'd love to work with you. Come on over. You know, you and I and the other people at Rangeley's three or four people, so it's not very big. We'll kind of run this. You know, we'll hustle and we'll do whatever we can do. So that's how I kind of came over to Rangeley and started everything.
And so it's the fund is called Special Ops.
Yeah, so my fund is called Rangeley Capital Special Opportunities, and we actually run three funds. We run a SPAC-focused fund, which, you know, all of a sudden has become We launched a SPAC focused fund before it was hot. You know, a year and a half ago, we looked at SPACs and we saw like, hey, you know, you can buy these for $10 per share and you get kind of equity like returns with treasury like risk, right? And all of a sudden this year, it's become you buy them for $10 per share and you get like levered beta times 50 equity upside returns with treasury risk. So that's been, you know, I can't talk returns or anything, but that's been really interesting, really good. And anybody's interested in SPACs, we can talk about that. I'm obsessed with SPACs, actually. We can talk about that all day if you want. And then we run an event fund, which is more traditional merger arb and event. And then special ops, which is the fund I run. Focus, it's more concentrated investing. And you and I were kind of talking before we started taping, you know, when I launched, I thought it was going to be much more the traditional deep value net nets, low price to earning stuff. And over time, probably more as my strategies evolved, it's become a little bit more, hey, you know, the value here is more in, it's in different stuff, right? Like, yes, it might look expensive on a trailing basis, but if you look forward 3 years, it's really cheap. Or, hey, there's this really complicated merger that's going on, but if you kind of strip out a lot of the merger noise, I think this is going to look good. Or a great example is a cable company, right? 3-4 years ago, everyone was concerned about, everyone knew what cable cord cutting was, and everyone was concerned about these businesses with cable cord cutting. And 3 or 4 years ago, I looked at it and said, hey, well, you know, the revenues go down because video costs $100 per month and cable internet is $50 per month. But actually, their profits go up because, you know, video, you have to pay ESPN and Disney and all these things. Broadband, your profit is, it's basically 100% profit margin at that point. So I was looking at that and saying, hey, like the demand for cable is growing. They've got great pricing power. So you have this thing where the story is revenues going down, cord cutting, all this competition. But the actual truth was revenue going down, profits going up, value going up, the business was getting more valuable. So those are the types of things I like to look at.
So that's an interesting insight. Let's talk a little bit about SPACs. When I first encountered SPACs was probably a little bit more than a decade ago, when the way that you played SPACs was you found the ones that were getting close to their the 2 year period that they had to actually do a deal, and they all traded at a big discount to basically the cash that they had to return. And so you played these busted SPACs so that you basically got there were like little special situations where you basically got the $10 back. So what's changed and what's the focus now?
Well, you know, I think what's changed, I think that's the way you played, most people played them until about a year ago, I'd say, with it was Chamath's IPOA, which turned into Virgin Galactic SPCE, which, you know, he bought it, it captured kind of the retail mentality, and it went from 10 to 30 in a day. And I think that's the one that really changed the dynamics for these things. But now what it's become is a SPAC is it's $10 sitting in trust that if you announce a merger with anything that's connected to an electrical vehicle play, it's worth $30 per share the next day, right? So it's almost a license to make money. And I'm obsessed with them because, A, you know, like Pershing Square Holdings right now, right? That has $20 per share in trust value. And that's a very unique structure we can talk about. But it trades at $25 per share right now. So investors are saying, hey, Bill Ackman's the one who runs Pershing Square, we like you so much that the $500 million you're sitting on, we're going to value that at $700 million, right? $600 million, $700 million. And not only that, but when you do this deal, we're going to get diluted down because the founder shares are going to dilute us down. So we actually think you're going to be able to announce a deal that's so good that you're basically going to create 40% of value out of thin air. And that's actually, you know, you see a lot of these, the EV SPACs, they're all agreeing to mergers that value them at $1 billion. And the next day the market's saying, no, you're worth $4 or $5 billion. And it's just insane to me that, you know, two rational parties, if you and I announced the deal at $100 million and the market came around and valued that deal at $300 million, it would just seem weird to me.
Yeah. So is that something that is sustainable, do you think?
I don't think it's sustainable. So, you know, this year, I think I don't have the stats for any, but I think there's going to be 300 SPAC IPOs. And in a normal year, there's like, I think there's something like 80 normal IPOs, 80 to 120. So if you think about that, there's going to be almost three times as many SPAC IPOs as normal IPOs this year. And that there's not three times as many kind of IPO-able companies. So I think at some point there has to be a reckoning where there's just not enough companies to go public through these SPACs. So you know, I've been thinking, do I want to do a 2021 piece? But if I did, like, one of my predictions for 2021 is a lot of these SPACs that haven't announced deals are just going to, they're going to go without deals and they're going to have to liquidate and pay their $10 per share back, or they're going to announce deals and at some point investors are going to say, that company is not a public company ready company. You paid too much, all this. And I think we're going to see a lot of SPACs end up liquidating, would be one of my predictions for SPACs. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be great SPACs in there. But I do think we're going to see a lot of SPACs liquidating on the back end of this.
So with a SPAC-focused fund, how do you pass the opportunities?
You know, so I help a lot on the SPAC-focused fund, but Chris actually manages the SPAC-focused fund. So I don't want to put words in his mouth per se, but you know what it originally started as was, hey, we're gonna go buy, again, this was before kind of the SPCE like mania, and it was, hey, we're gonna do a lot of diligence on the managers, we're going to invest in managers we like at $10 per share, right? We're gonna have this parked in trust, and if they announce a deal we like, great, but most likely what we're looking to do is kind of fund the deal and not take a lot of upside risk. But again, I don't want to speak particularly to the SPAC-focused fund. I'm happy to talk my views on SPACs, but I don't want to speak to the SPAC-focused fund, if that makes sense.
All right. Well, let's talk special ops. Let's talk about the strategy in special ops and where you're finding opportunities.
Yeah. Well, not to bring it back to SPACs, but what, again, well, the strategy for special ops, it varies, but I always want to pay, you know, I want to buy something for less than it's worth is the overall strategy, right? I'm a value investor. But it varies over time. You know, when I launched special ops, I thought that the definition of that was I buy things for 4x price earnings when the market's at 10x price earnings, or, you know, I buy net nets. And over time, that's evolved. One of the things I found really interesting, like being on the other side of the SPAC mania craze is what I like to call it. So, you know, I published a piece on Pershing Square Holdings, right? The volatility on that thing is off the charts right now. And I'll put a disclaimer out there. Options are risky. Everyone should consult a financial advisor. You know, options are like big boy plays. You don't want to do this naked. But Pershing Square Holdings right now trades for $25 per share. They do not have a deal announced. They have $20 per share in cash. You can go write a put option for $20 per share for March. And right now, I think you'd get paid, it was more when we were doing this, but you'd get paid about 30 cents. So you'd get 1.5% of your money back for 3 months for writing $20 per share put. But if you think about what needs to happen for Pershing Square to go below $20 per share, which is their trust value, the only way that could really happen is if they announced the deal and the market hated the deal so much that right now the market's saying, Bill, $20 per share in your hands worth 25. They say, oh, actually your deal was worth less than 20. Not only that, but you'd have the option to redeem your shares for $20 per share, right? So the only way that it could go below that is if they could close a deal before that option expired. And if you look at the history of SPACs, it takes about 90 days from deal announced to deal close. So this, options are risky. I don't ever want to say free money, but it looks kind of like free money because there's no way that they could announce a deal and close it before these options expire, right? So you write the put. If it goes below 20, you'll have the shares put to you, but then you'll just redeem them into any Bill Ackman deal. And there's a lot of different ways to kind of play the SPAC mania. And I think it's because SPACs have done so well, the implied volatility on the SPACs, it's higher than Tesla. It's higher than Moderna. You know, it's higher than Moderna, which just had a COVID vaccine approved. And nobody knows what the financials of rolling out a COVID vaccine is, or how many doses they're going to be, or how many vaccine manufacturers they're going to be. But the volatility on these SPACs is higher than that. And this is for cash shells, right? And that's just something that fascinates me to no end.
I think the Moderna insiders have an idea. I see them doing a lot of selling.
Well, you know, that's interesting. And I'm not a Moderna expert, but they've been selling really heavily since 60, 70, right? And now Moderna's at 150, 160. And I do think there's a lot of these places. You know, Tesla's a longtime favorite of every value investor to dunk on, right? And Tesla, for a long time, we had a short position in it to our huge detriment. But, you know, I remember when it was $200 per share before the split, and insiders were selling, you know, they would have options that didn't expire till 2027. And they would sell the day those options vested. So they'd give up 6 years of the option premium for one of the highest volatility stocks on the market just to get their cash. And, you know, I think value investors looked at this and said, oh, my God, that's one of the biggest red flags I've ever seen. And similar to Moderna, hey, they're selling everything they can at 60 or 70. They probably think the Pfizer vaccine's better. Well, you know, it's short term because they were doing that over the summer and now we're in the winter and the stock's at 150. But Tesla, you know, Tesla's a 12x since the CFO was selling yeah. every share he could get his hand on.
Tesla defies all gravity logic, as far as I can see.
You know, I listened to, not to pitch someone else's podcast, but Bill Brewster had the Acquirers podcast, which I've really been enjoying. Oh, you just went on it. I haven't yeah. gotten to listen to your episode. You tape a 2.5-hour episode. It's tough to find time for, but I will because I've really enjoyed it. But he had Super Magatu on there, and he said, look, when you and I are talking and we're like, it's an electric car company, they're never going to make money. And then the bulls are talking and saying, they're going to put something on the moon. Like
they're going to put something on Mars. There,
you know? Yeah.
When you're one of the strategies that you were talking about earlier was looking at something that can grow significantly over the next 3 years, you buy it cheap now relative to where it can grow to. So what sort of companies fit that profile and how are you thinking about those?
Yeah, so a good classic example would be Match.com, which one of my favorite companies, one of my favorite investors to follow is IAC, which is Barry Diller's holding company. And I just love how, A, they look at the world, and B, how they've evolved over the years. But, you know, about 3 years ago, I got really into Match.com. And this is one of the ones that really kind of opened my eyes as an investor, I would say. And Match.com shares were at about $18 per share at the time. And I had just met my soon-to-be wife online. And, you know, we met on a Tinder competitor, but all my friends were on Tinder and everyone was on Tinder. And there was this big debate. You know, people would say, oh, Match trades at 30 times EBITDA. How are they ever going to justify this valuation? And I said, 30 times EBITDA? Like, are you guys crazy? Like, Tinder hasn't even started monetizing yet. People would say, how is Tinder ever going to monetize? And I'd say, well, they've got every 20 or 30 year old in the country is on Tinder looking for their life partner or, you know, looking for a one night stand, but they're looking for something. And at some point, if everyone's on the product doing that, like they're going to be able to monetize this and it's going to be absolutely enormous when they figure out the right way to monetize this. So, you know, Match was at 18 then, and we're about 3 years later, 3.5 years later from when I put out my piece on them, and Match today is around $150 per share. And, you know, I think that's looking and saying, hey, the financials, they have zero value from Tinder in them at that time, basically. And Tinder is the biggest product of all time for sex. It is. And, you know, a similar one right now, I just published a piece, you know, history rhymes, Angie's List, which Home Advisor's Angie, which is Angie's List, Home Advisor, handy if you've ever used them. They're trying to build out the local marketplace for home services, right? And this morning, Facebook announced that the information had an article that said Facebook is looking into moving into this product category, and Angie's stock kind of opened down 10%. And I said history rhymes because 2.5 years ago, Facebook announced they were moving into online dating, and Match's stock fell 20%. And here we are 3 years later, nobody uses Facebook dating, and Match's stock is a 5x since then. And, you know, with Angie's List, I think history kind of rhymes because Facebook wants to move in there. I think they've got a lot of local market network effects, similar, but, it rhymes. It's not the same, but it's similar to what Match had in local dating. I think Angie's too far ahead for Facebook to really make the moves that they would need to make to beat them. And, you know, I think Match was a 5x over 2.5 years, and that's a really good outcome. But I think Angie could be a 5x over the next 3 to 5 years because of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I saw Rishi Gosalia had a comment either under your tweet or under another one where he said that if it's not in the top five priorities for a $1 trillion company, it's like a poorly funded startup. And so he didn't think it was going to be much of a competitor.
No, I think that's great. You know, for years, everyone's been saying Netflix is dead in the water, right? Apple is going to roll out Apple TV and it's going to be free and everybody's going to cancel their Netflix subscription. Amazon's going to put Amazon Prime TV in there and everybody's going to cancel the Netflix subscription because they already have Prime. Why would they pay for Netflix? And the answer is Netflix is fanatical about one thing. That's video. They have, I actually like some shows on other services better, but they've got the best service, you know, like little things. Like if you watch Disney Plus, if you watch an episode, at the end, the credits pop up. And you have to watch all the way through to the end of the credits for it to go to the next show if you're on Disney Plus. If you're on Netflix, you don't have that issue. You watch to the end of the show, you see 2 seconds of credits, and then boom, next episode. Yeah. And that seems like a small thing, but that just shows there's a maniacal focus on delivering the best consumer experience at Netflix, which Disney Plus is Disney's priority right now. They don't have that yet, right? Amazon TV, they've never had that. And for something like Angie's List Home Advisor, their one focus is on figuring out the consumer marketplace for local services. Facebook, that's priority eight. You know, they've got to stop from being broken up. They've got to steal all Snapchat stuff. Mark Zuckerberg has to go kill his own meat and eat his own dinner tonight. Like, that's not high up on the priorities for them. So it's probably not going to work.
How do you find your ideas, and then how do you sort of filter and validate what you're looking for?
Ideas all over the place. You know, I think it's tough for anyone to say they have proprietary idea sourcing at this point, because we all kind of look in the same wells. I'd say, you know, valueinvestorsclub.com, Sum Zero, Seeking Alpha, like all these places, varying qualities, but I think everybody's kind of looking in the same place. We all follow the same 13 F's and everything. So I'd say all of those. I think the best place actually has been, one of the great things about having an online presence has been, people will shoot you, will kind of ping you and say, hey, this seems like it's up your alley. And a lot of times they'll come with a fully kind of fleshed out thesis and they'll say, what do you think? And I'll say, Oh, that looks really cool. You know, the one I'm most jealous of, Mike over at Non-Gap, who I sing his praises all the time, but he's done incredible work with saying, oh, this company, they normally grant options in June. This year they granted them in March. Yeah. They're probably doing that because they think the stock's going to go up a lot before June. And now I'm really jealous, because I think a lot of people do ping him and say, hey, my company normally grants options in June and they just granted a bunch of options in January. What do you think? So he's got this great kind of incoming thing of, hey, these people are repricing their options at the interesting times. But I think that's actually been the best place for looking at them, for getting interesting ideas recently.
So you're getting a source of ideas externally being brought to you. That's ideal.
I think it's, you know, everybody gets their ideas though in place. I do think that's one proprietary place where I have it. And then at this point, you know, I followed so many companies for so long that a lot of them will, you know, they kind of recycle in waves, right? Like Discovery Communications, I followed that for years. And I kind of, at the end of November leading into their investor day, I kind of thought it got interesting. And I had 5 years worth of notes built up over that and a long history with it. So, you know, you follow companies for a long time, they recycle. But the external ideas, I do think there is something to that.
Let's talk about Discovery, because that's been cheap for a little while. The bear case on it is that it's the programming that people don't necessarily seek out. It's sort of programming that you put on in the background while you're doing something else, and you might not necessarily go and pay for it if it's unbundled. But what's your take on it?
I think they laid out the bear case well. I think the bull case would be, hey, if you subscribe to the cable bundle right now, right? The cable bundle is effectively sports, news, and Discovery. And the cable bundle does want to offer something for the viewer who doesn't want sports or news. And increasingly, that is Discovery, right? And Discovery's argument is, hey, you know, half of women who watch TV in America watch us. And if you look at our pricing per hour versus a ESPN or any of these sports things, like, we are massively undervalued. And by the way, you know, right now in the cable bundle, you pay $2 per month for us versus, you know, $10 for just ESPN. And that's $2 per month for HGTV, Food, Discovery, all these shows. We're going to switch it over at some point to Discovery Plus, and people will pay $6 per month for Discovery Plus. And, you know, so that means as we go from the bundled world to the unbundled world, maybe we lose half of our subs, but we get 3x the pricing. So I think that's the bull case. You know, I've never quite gotten there on the bull case, because I do think the bear case has a lot to it, where, yes, I do think they've got great personalities people seek out, like Guy Fieri, all these things, Chip and Joe, 90 Day Fiance, all this type of stuff. But, you know, you do run into, hey, for $15 per month, I can get Netflix. And Netflix has Planet Earth and all that type of stuff. And for 80% of households, is that enough kind of natural programming versus actually going out and paying $6 for Discovery? I don't know. But it is very cheap, and I think there's a lot of interesting optionality there. And the bull case would be, hey, Discovery is launching Discovery Plus as we speak, and go look at what Disney stock did when they from Disney Plus launched today. If Discovery does that, and by the way, they've got tons of cash flow and all this sort of stuff, I mean, it's a ginormous home run.
When you're managing the portfolio, so how do you size positions when they come in? Do you trim? Do you rebalance? How do you think about diversification?
You know, it's always evolving. So the way I've run special ops is generally about 20 positions, 3 to 5 core positions that are going to be very large. They're going to make up 3 to 5 positions are going to make up 60 to 75% of the portfolio. So quite concentrated. And then the other 15% of the positions, which make up, let's say 25%, you know, that's pretty small. So those are more eventy type stuff, interesting names like these SPAC type ideas, like the Pershing Square we talked about would kind of fit in there. And it varies, you know, with the cable companies, you know, a couple years ago, Charter was at 300 and I thought it was enormously undervalued. Today, Charter is at 650. I think it's undervalued. I don't think it's as undervalued, but you know, if you're selling, there's tax consequences, all that. So it's very difficult. And you know, selling a cable company where I've got such clear line of sight to their future versus a Discovery where you might think there's a lot of upside, but there are a lot of more questions on that. It's really tough to give a firm answer.
So yeah, but the what about diversification? Does that play into it, or you just take the opportunities where you find them?
You know, diversification, it's tough. Again, it evolves over the years because I do think like there were times where my three best ideas were three cable companies, and if I had just gone with those and kind of hashtag never sold, I think I would have outperformed a lot versus what I actually did, which was have one cable company be a ginormous position, it kind of ignore the other two, and diversify into things that I didn't like as much, but that didn't have the same cable company risk. But, you know, you can say that now with the benefit of hindsight versus, you know, I know a lot of people who 2 years ago, oil was their best idea, and they had three oil companies were their three largest positions, and, you know, benefit of hindsight, that was a mistake, so... It's tough. It's always evolving. I wish I had like a real straight, firm answer for you that you and I could write a book about and put it down and our listeners would walk away. But I really don't. You know, I do think there's a lot, especially when you run a more concentrated portfolio, I think there's a lot of art versus science to it. And, you know, I'm always trying to improve that art side of it.
How's your fund structured?
What do you mean?
Is it a limited partnership or are you managed accounts? How do you do it?
It's a hedge fund. It's a hedge fund. Yeah.
And so, when you're, I mean, that creates its own problems when you're reasonably concentrated and you've got money flowing in and out. How do you handle the flows? How do you think about that?
Well, we're still in startup mode. So, most, but I think all the investors I know and we talk to, and it's been a debate, you know, I think we structured it so there are benefits to investing for, you know, you get lower fee classes, you get better fee classes and better terms for having a longer term time horizon and committing to a little bit more of a lockup and stuff. And, you know, we've talked to them. I do think it's kind of cliche, but I don't like people like to say shareholder base is a company's edge, which I don't believe that at all. You know, I think companies are going to get valued like they get valued at some point. And I think people who say that are only saying that for really high multiple companies. But I do think for a hedge fund, like a shareholder, your hedge fund base can be a little bit of an edge. Like you need to talk to them, make sure that there's a similarity in vision. You know, the one nightmare I think most hedge fund managers have is the Michael Burry situation where, you know, in 2006, 2007, everyone's redeeming and pulling money from you because you underperform a little bit short term when you actually had like that killer 100x idea and it just needed a little bit more time to play out. But you had probably some more institutional investors who didn't really know you, who measured you on short term performance and marks and all of that.
Yeah, that makes it tough. When you think about the level of the market, does that play any role in whether you're carrying some cash or whether you're sort of sizing up positions?
More art than science, but I will say that's really evolved for me, particularly over this year with, you know, I came into this year, I thought markets fairly valued, but I thought there were some really interesting opportunities out there. And then like you have COVID and things pull back really quickly and not having cash to play there is just, you know, I think, if you and I had just gone to the beach and slept and then we woke up in March with the past 10 years, we'd had 100% of our portfolio in cash. And then we kind of woke up in March, deployed it all from March 15th to March 31st. And that's all we did. Like we'd probably outperform 99% of funds, right? So
your 10-year track record still look pretty good.
It would. So I think a little bit for me has been, hey, even when you've got a lot of interesting, great ideas, like really interesting, good ideas, there is something to, hey, hold a little bit back for things just get absolutely more crazy. Or, you know, you have the Facebook announces match dating and Match's stock is down 30% because everyone's losing their minds and nobody's thinking, you know, Facebook has a problem here and it's going to take them years to roll out. And is this really going to be top priority? So it's evolved a little bit to, hey, even it's not that I'm paying attention to the market, but I want to make sure I've got a little bit something held back for when everything goes from good to, oh my God, screamingly amazing, awesome.
One of the interesting things that you raised before, Mike Nongap, he just tweeted this out, but it's something that I saw Dan Loeb made a comment a little earlier that he looks for these, and I think that Match and Angie's List probably meet this definition where maybe it's not necessarily activism, but where there's some activist event and then a better company gets spun out. And if you just hold those, I mean, this is almost like the reverse Greenblatt, where Greenblatt used to say buy the company that had got in the spin, buy whatever's got sold the most heavily, yep. Right? And everybody did that for a long time, and all of those returns kind of went away. And I think it's sort of slowly drifted to the other side of the boat now, where you buy the better company in the spin. And I think that's what Dan Loeb was saying, that out of the when they do their activism and they sort of cause a company to be spun out, then they've found that that's the event that leads to a kind of a compounder type, you know, more focused management team in a slightly better business. And given enough time, that can work. And so he was sort of floating an idea where you just buy these things, just sort of put them away in a never sell portfolio and let them go like coffee can, these ideas, because you're getting a much better business. Do you see that anywhere? It's
an interesting thought, because I agree with a lot. Like, you know, I do think 20 years ago, spinoffs were all the rage, and I still look at pretty much every spin, but I think companies also got wise to that, where, hey, if we spin shitty assets, a bunch of event investors are just going to come buy these assets, and we can kind of offload our assets, have an inflated price for a second, we'll restrike all our stock options, the crappy company can go raise a bunch of equity if they need to. Like, I think they got wise to that, and I do think there is something to, hey, you spin off the bad business, and we're living in a world of a lot of we're living in a world with, you know, we've never seen returns to scale like the internet world allows. So if you spin a bad company off from a good company, and that good company can focus and kind of go from good to great, like the returns to that are astronomical, right? So there's certainly something to that.
What are you hunting for at the moment? How's your strategy sort of evolved? Is there anything particularly interesting right now?
Well, we mentioned SPACs. I think, you know, I don't want to go long every EV company at all, but I do think there's a lot of interesting dynamics around SPACs. Again, options are risky, but it's been widely, everyone knows about the SPAC warrant things, where, you know, their warrants will trade for a 40% discount to the stock. And I actually think there's reasons for that, and a lot of reasons have to do with, like, the warrants aren't fully exercisable yet. The stock's not borrowable, so shorts kind of can't arb that. So I'm not sure if there's opportunity there or if it's actually a function of like no borrow availability, but there's definitely interesting opportunities with SPAC. That's obviously far, far, far more on the eventy side. But then on the on the more value side, Angie's List is something I'm looking at. I think a lot of these companies that aren't growing 30% per year, they're growing 5, 10, 15%, but they lead their categories, and there's the possibility for them to kind of, I like to call it leveling up into kind of tangential services and stuff. I think a lot of those companies sell at really interesting multiples and have a lot of interesting optionality in a bunch of different ways. You know, a lot of like Finchwit's favorites, Dropbox right now, I think that's super interesting.
Yeah.
That's one of Finchwit's favorite. Again, Angie's List is one that I really like. And there's a couple more I'm working on that I think are pretty interesting.
How well do you know Dropbox?
Very well.
So do you want to give us the Dropbox thesis? Because it looks like it's transitioned from being a kind of a more fintech kind of science experiment to they're now it's starting to look like a real business.
Yeah, so the Dropbox thesis, I think I'm trying to pull up all my notes here so I can give you precise numbers. I don't know if that's going to work with the podcast, but the thesis is really simple, right? Like Dropbox has 100 million plus people use Dropbox. I think they have about 15 million active paying users, right? And when you look at that, this is a product that people are using. Like, I use Dropbox to save all my files. That should be a very sticky business. It trades very cheaply. It's run by, you know, everybody loves the founder or CEO. It's run by Drew, the founder. He still runs it. He's got a very option stock price heavy incentive system. He owns a lot of stock, but he's also, you can see this in the 10-K. He's got, I think it's called the founder's grant, where if the stock hits 30, he gets one payout, 32, 35, all this sorts of stuff. They lay out all their targets. They say, hey, we're going to do $1 billion of cash flow by, I think it's 2023. And if you look at their history of meeting the numbers they put out, you know, this is a company that does not miss when they give guidance. They consistently beat their guidance. So I think you add it all up and you say, hey, cheap company run by a founder who, by the way, I think nobody gives him credit, but he's a founder of Dropbox, and he tried to buy Slack for, I think it was $1 billion. And I believe the story is his board turned him down, right? And Slack just got bought by for $35 billion by Salesforce. And, you know, there is a lot of people like to say, oh, Blockbuster could have bought Netflix for $1 million or something, right? Well, it's probably a different company and a different product in someone else's hands. But I do think there is something to, here's this heavily incentivized founder who built Dropbox, who saw the future clearly enough to want to buy Slack for $1 billion. And I think there would have been huge synergies there. Like, there's always most of these guys have kind of product number two or insight number two when they do this. You know, Jeff Bezos had not just Amazon, he had Amazon Web Services and a bunch of other ones. I think that this guy, he's going to have a product number two, right? And even if he doesn't, if you just look at the core business you're paying for, you're paying a very cheap multiple. And if they hit their long-term numbers, you're paying a super cheap multiple. And again, this is a company that doesn't miss numbers. So I think it's cheap. I think it's got optionality. I think it's got a great founder. I think that's kind of the overall financial pitch for it.
And he sits on the Facebook board too, so there's always a potential for something there.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right, but what would the Facebook Dropbox synergies be? And does Facebook really want to get into another acquisition when they've got the FTC breathing down their back saying,
well, that's a good
hey,
point.
Your past acquisitions have done too well. We have to take them back from you.
The Instagram acquisition, when it was like two guys in a Bloomberg, it was like 15 guys with a money losing product.
Look, it's so I talked earlier about how Match opened my eyes, and Instagram, I remember people hated on them. It was, I think the numbers were 39 employees for $1 billion, and Facebook paid all stock, and people said, are you insane?
It's 39
employees, no
it's
revenue
crazy.
For $1 billion?
Yeah.
Dollars? And that was one of the ones where I looked at it and said, are you guys crazy? Like, this has 30 million active users, and they just bought this, and the synergies between are going to be huge. Like, this seems like a pretty darn good deal if you look at the optionality. And so that's a different story. But yeah, you know, for Dropbox, I do think there are companies that could acquire it, you know. Who thought Salesforce was going to buy Slack? I don't think a lot of people thought that was going to happen, and they paid a very nice premium for that business. I don't think Dropbox fits quite as neatly into any company's portfolio, but there's a lot of people who've Dropbox downloaded. They've got a lot of credit cards on file. You know, I think there's a lot of different things that Dropbox could do, either as someone else's acquisition target or for Dropbox going and growing the business.
Yeah, I like Dropbox as an opportunity too. I also like the idea of finding these guys who've got product number two. I think that's a good approach.
Yeah. And you look at the history of guys who build multi-billion-dollar businesses. I mean, it's not guaranteed because there's a lot of luck to building a multi-billion-dollar business. But, you know, everybody wants to back these founder-led huge growth stories. And there's Dropbox sitting right there,
right.
Multi-billion-dollar company led by its founder, CEO. He's got, you know, he owns a lot of equity. He's got a lot of optionality to grow the company. And he's proven that he can see the ball really clearly going forward. I think it's kind of crazy that you can get the optionality of him doing something for more than free.
It meets that rule of 40. It's just that it's not so much on the growth side, I think, is the problem.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if Dropbox, you know, if their profits were a little lower but their growth was a little higher, I think people would be going crazy.
That's it.
And there is... You know, the big question with them is there are terminal value questions, because a lot of what they do you can get for free on Google Drives, you can get for free from a bunch of other places. So I hear that, but it comes back to what we said with Angie's List versus Facebook, right? Like, Dropbox, one thing is storage and making your life easier with storage. That's probably 15th down the line for Google and for Microsoft. A lot of people are putting their money where their mouth is and like paying for this product. I think they're focused, and I think they can do a lot with it.
There's also a reasonable argument for an independent. If you don't want to be associated with Google or with Apple or with whoever else, you can go and work with Dropbox, and it's a totally independent company.
they've made this argument before, and they've even said like they were doing a lot of integrations with Slack. I kind of thought them and Slack still might get together, like, you know, the coalition of the independent stuff. But you know, just like something simple, like if you use Google Sheets for your business, and I use Microsoft Excel, and we're going back and forth, like that can make it really difficult. And like, it probably doesn't matter for us, but if you're a lawyer and all your clients are on different products and stuff, having an independent thing that integrates with all of them actually has a lot of value for them. So yeah.
I like the product number two idea a lot, because I think that another good example of that is Jack at Twitter with his secondary Square and now Cash App. It seems to be a pretty good example of that. Product number two doing quite well. I just wish you could do a little bit more with product number one.
Yeah, I was about to say, some people might argue that Square was product number one and Twitter's like accidental mess up product number zero or something. But yeah, I mean, Jack and Twitter, Elon with what, 17 different businesses now. There are a lot of examples of these, and it's tough, but I love getting that optionality for free.
Do you have any other good examples? Do you have any other interesting opportunities?
Let's see. I'm just pitching the whole book.
Why here. Not?
What else have I been researching a lot recently? So I put a lot on the blog. I'm just trying to think of ones that I've been into recently, not necessarily recommendations or anything.
We were on a small and microcap panel recently. How do you come to be on the small and microcap panel from a background in small and microcap rather than like a current focus?
I think again, when I launched Special Ops, I thought how I was going to build it and structure it and how I thought about the world was going to be very different. So I've got a lot of background. I still spend a lot of time looking at small and microcap companies. Actually, one of the things that I kick myself in regret is there were two or three real winners on the smaller microcap side that I think I did the classic, value investor thing. And I sold out way, way too early. I have an article on Seeking Alpha the day 3M filed a lawsuit against them saying that I think they're going to win that. And I think my cost basis was $1.50 and I sold for $2. InfuSystem was one where I had a huge position in it. And I think that trades for $15. And, it it's one of those things I'm trying to evolve and learn from. But a lot of these times when you find a good company and they, if you're a value investor and they trade from 8x earnings to 12x earnings, a lot of times you say that's enough. But if it's a good company and you've really built conviction and you understand it, you can say, oh, it's 12x trailing earnings, but it's 2x what I think their 2 years ahead of earnings are, or it's half times what I think like kind of the strategic optionality to an acquirer is 5 years out. So I spent a lot of time looking at microcap.
InfuSystems was a net-net, wasn't it?
Oh, InfuSystem was a net-net. They had accounting issues. They had all these issues. And for years, I mean, I talked to their board. I was helpful, and they had an activist who kind of reconstituted the board. I was helpful to him. Eventually, I just got, I had held it for 3 years, and the IRR was kind of middling, and I just got sick of they were always promising, and they never delivered, and the market just didn't seem to care. And I think the day I sold was 2 days before the stock has gone on like a 5x run. But that was one where I think I saw the value very clearly. Again, I don't know if I'm making myself look like a loser or trying to pay myself as a profit. It's neither. I'm just saying, like, I think I saw the value clearly, and I got a little sick of it, and it got like, I was married to, hey, this, I want to buy this for less than 10 earnings. The day it went over 10 earnings, I sold it, and that was a mistake.
So where do you fall on never sell or selling as a value guy? What's the process?
I think you sell, but you sell... I'm not a never sell guy, and I do think a lot of never sell is the current environment where we're looking at companies that have scale that we've never seen before, right? Like if you were in the 1920s and you practiced never sell, any decade but this decade, never sell would have been an awful decade to practice. I think some of never sell is 0% interest rates lets you pull a lot of the future value forward. And I think some of never sell is a correct identification that in today's environment, Walmart 50 years ago, they were going to take a lot of value, but they couldn't take all the value. Whereas today, if you take that, if you're the winner in a market, you take all the value in that market, and you might take all the value in every tangential market to you, right? So I think a lot of never sell is identifying, hey, you don't sell a business when it's priced at 50x earnings, because if it goes and takes 5 tangential markets, it's 2x earnings. So I kind of disagree with I think they've identified something, hold really good companies until they take every kind of thing they can take. But I think Neversell will reach its limits at some point as well.
Yeah, I think that there's, I mean, I think it's cyclical too. We saw it in the 70s with the Nifty 50. I think we saw it also in the late 1990s, not with the dot-com stocks, but just with, there are a lot of really good stocks. Walmart was one. Microsoft was one.
Great point.
GE, they just got, GE, not such a great business now, but it was, you know, Neutron Jack was kind of the CEO of probably the preceding decade at the time. And all of those companies just bumped sideways for 10 or 15 years after that point, even though there were great businesses underneath and still compounding at a high rate, they were just too expensive and it took a while for the underlying business to catch up with the stock price.
And, you know, Microsoft is an interesting one because Bill Gates retires. GE would be different because I think people look back on Jack Welch a lot differently with the benefit of hindsight. But Microsoft is really interesting because Bill Gates retires and he hands the greatest portfolio of tech assets in history to
Ballmer.
The guy. It's Steve Ballmer. Steve Ballmer. Yeah. He hands him the greatest. And the guy bungles it for 15 years. And if he hadn't been kind of like nicely forced out, I mean, what does Microsoft do? They missed a ton of boats, but their assets were so good that they could survive 15 years of mismanagement. You look at a lot of these companies today, right? Facebook, Amazon, their founders still have a very long runway ahead of them. So I don't think it's a super near-term problem. But at some point, someone else is going to be running those assets. And, you know, Apple, Tim Cook's been great. But you do kind of sometimes look at Apple and say, hey, what has Apple done under his under him, aside from continue kind of the Apple iPhone, Apple Watch, like everything under Steve Jobs, they've just continued and those assets were so great, but they haven't really introduced anything new, I would say. Facebook, Amazon, all these guys, at some point someone else is going to run them. And how does that look after 5 years of someone who isn't the founder running them?
I think the AirPods have been pretty successful. That might be one product people like.
You're probably right, but they're successful, but they're built on the iOS ecosystem. And any other company would love to have an EarPod success, but does that really budge the needle for Apple?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. We're coming up on time, Andrew. If folks want to follow along with what you're doing or get in contact with you, what's the best way to do that?
I think the best way, Twitter. It's so cliche at this point, but you know, I post a lot on Twitter. If you slide into my DMs on Twitter, I feel like I'm pretty responsive. So Andrew Rangeley on Twitter is a great way. I run Yet Another Value blog, which you can follow me. I write semi-frequently on there. Yet Another Value podcast, which you'll have to come on at some point, where I try to talk to guests, really dive deeply into one stock idea is kind of how I've done it. I've tried other formats, but that's really where I'm most passionate. I think the best conversations are. And I think those are the best ways.
Well, that's great. Andrew Walker Rangeley, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.